Welcome back to Franklin Covey's twice weekly podcast on Leadership with Scott Miller. That's me. I'm your host and interviewer each week. We're now for 6 years and 350 plus episodes taped. On Tuesdays and Fridays, we try to share with you podcast episodes, both in audio and video, that are designed to make you a better leader. Franklin Covey, of course, the world's most trusted leadership firm, co-founded by Dr. Stephen R. Covey, many of you know as the author of the seminal book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, where collectively our associates worldwide have gone on to build better leaders through hundreds of millions of professionals in literally every free country in the world. And this podcast is meant to take what is the Franklin Covey spotlight and platform and bring new insights from thought leaders in a variety of different spaces to you twice weekly to make you better, a better leader, a better parent, a better partner, spouse, human being. And we typically interview thought leaders, business leaders, athletes, celebrities, actors, researchers, people that have perhaps survived some tragedy that can share their story to make you a better person. This is not a book review podcast, but oftentimes thought leaders have books, and typically, almost always, it's nonfiction authors. Today, however, we've taken a little bit of a pivot, and we're interviewing one of the most famous novelists of my lifetime. His name is Mitch Albom. You know him from his 8 number one New York Times best-selling books. He's sold in languages and across the world more than 40 million copies of his numerous books. You probably know him as the author of the book Tuesdays with Maury, but today we're interviewing him on all of his books, the insights, his writing process, with a focus on his most recent release called The Little Liar, that I think is especially timely in an era, a political era, where we debate what the truth means, what are the opposite sides of the truth, how we manufacture our own truth, how our ability to tell the truth impacts our brand, and we'll talk about his book today. Honored to have the novelist and iconic author, Mitch Albom. Welcome to On Leadership.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for having me on the program.
Mitch, we have interviewed pretty much every literary titan that's been out there, certainly on the nonfiction business leadership self-help side. This, as you know, is a leadership podcast, but as a voracious reader and author myself, I have cherished, I think I've read all of your books, certainly from the beginning with Tuesdays with Maury, which I believe became a motion picture, am I right?
Yes, it did.
I think the book that had the most impact on me was this book about the 5 people you meet in heaven. For the last few people that may be listening or watching our podcast that aren't aware of the amount of time you've spent writing the last couple of decades, would you just maybe reorient everybody to your career as an author? I don't think you were born an author. Talk about what got you into the business and give maybe a broad landscape of what has brought you now to your most recent book, The Little Liar.
Well, I'm a good example of man plans and God laughs type of thing. I started out wanting to only be a musician. I never wrote for anything in high school or in college, not college newspaper or anything like that. I just wanted to play music, produce music. I did that for a couple of years when I got out of school overseas and then back in New York City. And as I was failing doing it in New York, I happened to walk into a supermarket one day and they were giving out a free newspaper that they would throw in your basket. And it said, would you, if you have free time, we could use some help putting out this newspaper. And since I worked at nights as a musician, I had some free time. I went down there. They gave me an assignment that day to write a story of parking meters. I'd never written anything, but I'd read a lot of newspapers in my life. And so I kind of went into this meeting about parking meters and wrote the story up the way a newspaper story I thought would go. And the next week when I was in the supermarket, I picked up the newspaper and there was my story on the bottom of the front page with my name attached to it. And I got that little tingle that you get when you create something with your name. And I've been a writer ever since. And then when I got into journalism, I ended up becoming a sports writer. And probably would have stayed a sports writer my whole life and a sports broadcaster on ESPN and other things like that. Except when I was 37 years old, I had a sort of an epiphany kind of experience where I connected with an old college professor of mine named Maury Schwartz, who was dying from Lou Gehrig's disease, and ended up visiting him every Tuesday that he had left in his life. and we sort of did a last class together on what it's, what you know when you're about to die, that puts everything else into perspective and how you could use that knowledge to be better when it comes to work and marriage and culture and money and all the rest of the things. And it was a great last class. It was not supposed to be a book, but when I found out that Maury was so in debt for his medical bills that he didn't have the money to pay it, and his family was going to have to sell their house to pay his bills, I decided to try to help him. And I found one publisher after everybody turned us down, one publisher who was willing to take a chance on this little book called Tuesdays with Maury. And they gave us enough money for him to pay his bills, which I gave to him. I wrote this little book, which I didn't think anybody would read. And I prepared to go back to become, you know, being a sports writer. And then that book came out and ended up becoming the most most read memoir in the history of publishing, and changed my life forever. And I've been on a path ever since of writing books that are not about sports, but about life and big picture issues about life and meaning of it, and what we can learn from being human to one another. And there's been 10 books since Tuesdays with Maury, and this is the newest one that I have out now. It's called The Little Liar. So I think in a couple minutes there, I've taken you from when I was 10 to where I am now. So I haven't bored you too much. That's the story of my life up till now.
I don't think I knew most of that story. I want to talk about The Little Liar before I go there. Your first book was Tuesdays with Maury. As you look back now with the benefit of hindsight, do you think, why was that book so successful? And had that not, had that book not been your first book, had you not written other books, was that book, I think, consequential enough that it provided you the platform? Talk about how the timing of that book helped it and helped you as an author in your own creative writing skills.
So I had actually written a couple of best-selling books before that, but they were sports books. One was a biography of autobiography of Bo Schembechler. One was about the Fab Five basketball team at Michigan. But I'd never known anything about a book like that. And it was not supposed to be a big book. They printed 20,000 copies of it total for the whole world. And I thought I'd have them in the trunk of my car for the rest of my life. So, you know, it speaks to the power of people passing a book around and passing a book around and saying, you should read this and you should read this. Because the book came out in August of 1997, which is not a good month for a book about the meaning of life to come out in August when everybody wants to just be reading beach books. And it didn't even get to a bestsellers list of any kind for about 4 months. And then it was just at the bottom. And it slowly started to work its way up. And it didn't reach number one on that bestsellers list until April of the following year, which is usually, by that point, books are long since forgotten and coming out in paperback already. So it really just sort of caught on fire. And I can tell you, based on my experience, why that is. I don't think it was anything brilliant that I wrote or my use of prose. I think it's because everybody who read it could identify with one of the two characters. Either they had a mentor like Maury, an older person, a teacher, a grandparent, you know, someone who was important in their lives, who gave them wisdom at a time when they needed it. Or they identified with me, kind of a way too ambitious, way too busy, why isn't life more satisfying kind of person at age 37. And I can't tell you how many people I will run into who will take out their wallets and say, here's my Maury. And they'll take out a picture of somebody and say, this is my Maury. And I think that that's why that book, not just in America, but all across the world, found such an audience, because everybody, no matter what culture you're in or country or language, has a Maury. So that's why the book became popular, I think. And in terms of what it did to me, I can just tell you, Scott, that before that, I was on ESPN and therefore pretty recognizable in airports, at least to guys. And people used to stop me in airports and say, hey, you know, sports guy, you know, who's going to win the Super Bowl? And I would say, you know, Patriots, and just kind of go up the escalator. And then after Tuesdays with Maury came out, people began stopping me and saying, hey, my mother died of cancer, and the last thing we did was read your book together. Can I talk to you about her? And you can't go up the escalator and say, Patriots, you know, and disappear. You have to stop and talk and engage and listen. And I've had that happen to me, not 10 times or 100 times or 1,000 times, but tens of thousands of times. And when you have something like that happen so often, you come to become sensitized to how people are suffering and what's really important to them and the grief that they endure. And it's not surprising that my focus became on those kinds of issues. And all the books that I have written since, I've never written a sports book again. All the books I've written since have been about that type of thing. So Tuesdays with Maury was not just a big book for other people. It was a seminal book in pivoting my life from one direction to another.
Mitch, I appreciate you taking the time to share about that, because it obviously instructs all the books you've written since, as you've said, including your current release called The Little Liar. This is a novel that follows a particular person through decades of their life as they have struggled with the truth, which is an issue we'll talk about in a moment in terms of American business, American politics. Give us a glimpse about, for those of you who are listening and watching right now, going on Amazon or their favorite bookstore site to pick up The Little Liar, talk us through the central character and the struggle that is central to this book.
Sure. So The Little Liar centers on actually four people. The biggest protagonist is a little boy named Nico, who's 11 years old, living in Greece during World War II. And when the Nazis invade his town, they find out that Nico, at age 11, has never told a lie in his life. And he's known throughout the village and the city as an honest boy. And so they decide to use him as a weapon. And when they herd all the other Jews into ghetto areas, they keep him and they say, we'll let you go back to your family. You just have to do us a little favor. For the next couple of weeks, we want you to stand on these train tracks. And as people are getting on and they're going to be confused, you just tell them they're going to good jobs and good homes and everything's going to be okay. And they'll believe you because they know that you're honest. And so because he's never lied before and he has no reason to suspect otherwise, he does this. Until the very last train is sent out and he sees his family and this little girl that he sort of loves being shoved into a boxcar and they're screaming at him. And that's when he realizes and finds out that these trains are actually going to the concentration camps into Auschwitz. And he's not allowed to get on the train. The Nazi who perpetrates this act keeps him from getting on the train. And so everybody he knows and loves is shipped away and he's left behind. And the book follows what happens to him, as well as the little girl that he loves, his brother who was sent to the concentration camps, and the Nazi who perpetrated this for the next 40 years, showing the ramifications of a single lie on four different lives and how it changes all of them just from that one act. And so it's really a parable about truth and lying, about hope and forgiveness over the course of the story. And it's something that I've been thinking about writing for many years, and I'm glad that I finally was able to do it.
Mitch, one of my favorite interviews in the 6 years of this podcast is a woman named Dr. Susan David. She is a renowned author. She wrote a book called Emotional Agility, has a very famous TED Talk, South African by birth, and lives in Boston. And she talks about how in life there are facts, and there then are feelings, emotions, and opinions. And oftentimes we conflate the two. Our feelings and emotions we present as facts. But it's important to know facts are facts and feelings and emotions are feelings. Again, both are important, but they're not the same. And I never thought that you and I would be having a conversation in 2024 where we were debating truth. People certainly have perspectives and political ideology and they have religious views, but it seems like now that the definition of truth is whatever the loudest, most charismatic, largest social following, the person who repeats it the most makes their own truth now. We know this is sort of commonplace in American politics. And how did, any opinion on how we got there and how we get away from that and how you might define truth versus lies? Maybe reground us in the principles we all know that from a guy I think who has a strong sense of moral authority in the books that you write, take that wherever you're comfortable going.
Okay, there's a lot of questions in there, Scott, but I'm going to try to answer them. First of all, let me recite you a quote. A lie told once is easily seen as a lie, but a lie told 1,000 times becomes the truth. You know who said that? A Nazi. Joseph Goebbels. And that was the philosophy that the Nazis used during that period of time. And if you think about the world that we live in now, social media, where people can put out a message very quickly that they know is false, and it can travel around the world in 15 seconds. A lie told once, easily seen as the truth. A lie told a thousand times, easily seen as a lie told a thousand times becomes the truth. We live in that world now. And when people decide they're going to choose their own cable TV network news and that they're only going to believe that side or the other side, or they're going to have their own politician only going to believe that and not the other thing, it's very easy for people to just sort of put blinders on and say, this is the truth and I don't have to hear about anything else. It's shocking to me, Scott, as someone who wrote a book that, you know, the first quarter of which takes place during the Holocaust, that a study just came out after October 7th and the attacks in Israel. A study came out that one in five young people under 25 or so in America think the Holocaust was a myth. One in five. And another 30% aren't sure, you know, one way or the other. So you're talking about almost half of young people in America who can't come out and say, as you say, there's facts and there's feelings, can't come out and say the Holocaust was true. Now, that same study showed that people over 65, 0% believe that the Holocaust is a myth. So obviously the people who were around during that time or know people who were around during that time can tell you, no, it's fact. This took place. 6 million Jews were killed. Millions of other peoples, Catholics and homosexuals and gypsies and all the rest were murdered. It's not deniable. This is not something that you can have a version of. It is the truth. And yet you have half of young people who can't even make that sentence. Why? Because someone has perpetrated some sort of lie or some sort of thing for whatever their purposes are that, you know, let's just deny this thing ever happened. And through social media, there are enough people that are just sort of buying into this and they don't look at anything else and they don't meet anybody else and they pick up their own version of the truth. So we are living in a very, very dangerous time for the truth. And it is very precarious. And when we have phrases like my truth, which are being celebrated, which is really nothing more than my story. There's a big difference between my story and my truth. The truth, there's one version of. The story, there's a millions of versions of. And somehow we need to determine the difference between the two, or we're headed for a very, very dangerous thing. And if you don't think that what happened in Nazi Germany could happen again, then you're not a very good student of history, because many of the things that launched that terrible campaign have already started happening in our society right now.
Thank you. It is despicable that anyone would deny the legitimacy of the Holocaust. And let us be very clear, the Holocaust happened. And you heard it from my voice here as well. We interviewed Tova Friedman, who you know of, who was a survivor of the Holocaust. And when you read her book and you listen or watch her interview with us, it is incomprehensible any educated human being would be anything other than horrified and sympathetic at the lives that were lost at the hands of the Nazis, like you said, beyond just the Jews, and that you're absolutely right, it could happen again. And it's, I think your book, although only a small part of it is about the Holocaust, it's about the decades that ensued with these four people's lives, is a great testament for all of us to differentiate between our story and the truth. Mitch, on a lighter note, you write fascinating novels that usually have multiple characters whose lives, you know, intertwine and come back together again. And you don't have one writing style. You have different architectures for your books. How do you come up with your ideas for the millions of people who are listening and watching to this, many of which have a book idea in their mind, fiction, nonfiction, novel, business, romance, science fiction? Is there any insight you might offer? I'm trying not to give you five questions again. Is there any insight you might offer in your own architecture and writing style and how someone defines and uncovers their own?
Sure. I'm fortunate enough to know a lot of writers. I play in a band of writers, Stephen King and Dave Barry and Scott Turow and Ridley Pearson and James McBride and many, many others. And over the years, we've hung out together, and I've had a chance to talk to all of them about their writing styles as they have with me. And what I've discovered is it's quite different. Everybody does things a little bit differently. And some of them, especially the novelists amongst them, they say, well, I just create my characters and I just sort of put them together and I let them sort of take me where they're going to take me. And I look at that with stunned eyes because I don't know how that works. You know, if I were to ask my characters, where are that you're going to take me? They would look up at me from the table and say, how the hell do we know? You know, you created us, you know, you're supposed to be telling us. So I work a little bit differently. I don't decide to make a book just because I think I have a good idea for a character, or even because I think I have a good idea for a plot. I decide to write my books, and again, this is just unique to me. Others do it quite differently. I try to pick a theme or a lesson that I think is important to me that I want to say something about. And I come up with that long before I come up with a plot or a character. So The Five People You Meet in Heaven, which you mentioned, Scott, is a book that you've enjoyed. So the idea of that book was not to write a book about heaven. The idea of that book was that nobody, there's no such thing as a nobody, that everybody counts. I had an uncle of mine who died thinking that he was a nobody. He would always say, I've never been nowhere, never done nothing. I don't matter to anybody. And I always thought that that was terrible because I loved him and I could never really convince him that he was important. So that was the idea behind The Five People You Meet in Heaven. But I found that I could tell that story by creating a story about a man who dies thinking that he didn't save a little girl from an amusement park accident, goes to heaven and finds, thinks that he's a nobody and goes to heaven and finds five people in his life who tell him, no, you did this and changed my life forever. You did this that changed my life forever. You did this that changed my life forever. So I try to do that with all of my books. I get a theme and then I put the characters and the story around it. And so if someone is trying to contemplate doing a book in the nature of the kind that I write, I would say that that might be a better way to do it. First, decide, you know, what your North Star is going to be in terms of what message do you want to say. With The Little Liar, I wanted to talk about how precious truth was and what would you do to be forgiven the biggest lie that you ever told. And with that in mind, I started to create this story about this little boy and in Greece and the Nazis and the Holocaust and all the things that come around it. But it didn't start with characters. It started with the theme or the lesson that I wanted to get out. And then I built the characters and the storyline around it.
Anything interesting to share in terms of when and how you write? Is there a cadence? Do you tend to take years or months? Is it every day at 3 a.m.? What works for you that might inspire people to find their own? And maybe you give permission to people that are writing books on how to find
their own. Yeah, sure. I hear that a lot. And let me tell you that all those writers that I mentioned before that are in the band or that I know, every one of them treats writing like a job. None of them sit around and saying, well, I'm just waiting for the muse to hit me. I'm waiting for, you know, 3 a.m. lightning's going to strike and I'm going to wake up and I'm just going to start typing. It doesn't work like it does in the movies. Every one of them, from Stephen King to Amy Tan to Dave Barry or disparate writers, just those three right there, they all get up every day and treat it like a job and go to work at it. And I do the same thing. My writing technique, I start, and it just works for me. I get up in the morning early, 6:37, something like that. And I go right to writing. You know, I'll grab a cup of something to drink and I go right to sit down and write. I don't watch anything. I don't read anything. I don't turn on any music. I don't have any other input. I want my brain to be, you know, devoid of any ideas in the morning, so that I can just have the ideas for my writing. And then I sit down and I write, and I don't write probably more than 2 to 3 hours a day. I've learned over time that you can sit in front of a computer all day long. That doesn't mean words are going to come. You know, that you have a certain amount of gas in the tank, and you should recognize how big your tank is and just drive until you run out of gas. And for me, that's about 2.5 hours, 3 hours. But I do it every day. Not just Monday through Friday, but every day. And I always try, and I found this to be a good technique, I try to finish on an upbeat note, like when things are going well. Because if you're in a paragraph or a chapter that's just not working and it's terrible and you don't like what you're writing and you go, I'll just get up and I'll do it tomorrow. But then when you wake up in the morning, you're not very excited about coming back down to it because you left a big pile of turd there, you know? And so you try to quit when things are going good so that when you wake up the next morning, you can't wait to get back down there because there's something, you know, positive that you're working on. So I always found that to be a good technique too.
Mitch, of your numerous books, how many have become movies? Just one, the first one?
Four have been made into movies, and I've done 10 books. I've done 12 books, if you count the sports books. All but two have been optioned and are in the process of various stage of becoming movies or television series or streaming series or things like that.
Well, given that track record, does that instruct how you write books? Because you know potentially this might become a major motion picture or made for TV, and there you think about the characters, or does it,
no.
You write agnostic of that?
No, I never do that. And I, you know, I think every writer, when they write fiction, probably has a face in mind of what their character looks like. And frequently that face may end up being an actor, because we know actors that way, or it might be somebody that you know, in your life, and you say, oh, he looks kind of like that guy I went to school with, or he looks like that woman who works at the grocery store. She looks like that. But I think if you start writing thinking, I'll write this way so they'll want to make a movie out of it, then you end up with neither a book nor a movie. Hmm. You know, people want to make movies out of great books. Sometimes they succeed and sometimes they ruin it. And we all know examples of both. But what inspires people to want to see a movie version of it isn't a book that's written like a movie. It's a book that's just a great read. And when you're finished it, you want to see it in some other form. So I only concentrate on trying to write a good book. And then, you know, if somebody wants to try to make a movie out of it, fine. The old joke was, I think it was Ernest Hemingway who said, if you want your, you know, books to be turned into movies, you should run to the California-Nevada border holding your manuscript, and you should throw all the pages over the line to California, and then you should run the opposite direction, because you're not going to like what's going to happen to it, and it's not going to be yours anymore. And I've seen that happen in the books that I've had transferred into movies, and even the ones that are being transferred into movies, and you have to sort of accept that, and you just have to say a book is a book, a movie is a movie. What works in one doesn't necessarily work in the other. And really, if it's a movie's 2 hours long, think about when you read a book, how far into the book are you after 2 hours? You might be, 60 pages in, the book might be 400 pages. So what does that tell you? That the other 340 pages don't get made, you know? So a movie has to, by its very nature, be very, just a shred of what the actual book is. And you can't start getting upset over that and saying, oh, well, they didn't have this in, or they didn't include this, or whatever. The best you can hope for is that the book is a good book and the movie is a good movie. And somewhere there's a connection between the two, but one cannot be the equal version of the other. They're just two different creations, apples and oranges.
I think you just liberated millions of people who are stuck on their movie not being what they liked in the book. What do you want the reader to do differently as a result of engaging with your newest release, The Little Liar? What do you hope happens?
Well, I'd like people to ask themselves, what's the biggest lie you ever told? Like Nico tells this lie in the book. What were the ramifications of that lie? Who did you hurt? Was a relationship ruined? Was a business dissolved? Were you not able to come back from certain things? And what would you do to be forgiven that lie? And Nico spends his whole life, after that moment, trying to be forgiven for the lie that he told. Ironically, he becomes a pathological liar because he can no longer tell the truth, because the truth is so painful to him because of what he thinks he did, that the only words that will come out of his mouth basically are lies. And so he learns how to be a really good pathological liar, how to forge checks, how to change his name, how to use phony passports, how to move about the world with all different identities. And he does this, and ends up actually in America as hugely successful, because, if you're a brazen liar, you can become hugely successful in America. And he does. and becomes very, very rich. But the whole time he is privately pining to be forgiven for what he did. And meanwhile, this little girl who always loved him when she was 12 years old, she's convinced that he, you know, he must have been duped. And she sets out to try to find him. And of course, he's changed his name and he's moved all over the world. So it takes her half a lifetime to try to find him again, just to forgive him. And so what I want people to learn from that is that the desire to be forgiven and the need to forgive are equally powerful forces in our lives. And we always think when it comes to forgiveness, it's just the person who's seeking to be forgiven that has the driving force, but that's not true. Inside of us, we also have an urge to forgive other people, because when we don't forgive people, it's like a two-sided blade, you know, part of it goes into them and part of it goes into us. And so I, you know, I want people to sort of understand a forgiveness theme as well. And the book is ultimately a hopeful book. It's not a down book. It's not a Holocaust book, like, you know, a horrific Holocaust book. It makes a point about the truth and forgiveness and hope. And I hope that those are the things that people take from it.
You've just given me the best liner in 6 years of interviews. Horrifyingly, if you become a brazen liar, you can be a huge success in America. Isn't that sadly true? Mitch, what's next?
I'm actually already working on my next book, which is more of a slight novel, not as heavy a subject. Basically, it deals with a person who magically gets to do everything twice in life. He gets to fix every mistake that he made, but he only gets two chances, and he has to live with the consequences of the second try. And it's a lot about the idea of grass being always greener and what happens when we jump to the other side of the grass and we leave behind, you know, what we had before. So again, I picked that theme, you know, because I think that's a universal theme. People are always thinking, you know, I should have done this, you know, or I should have married this person, or I should have, you know, I should have switched careers when I had the chance, or I should have been. And what would your life be like? That whole sliding doors kind of thing, you know, about if I lived in a different world. So this character actually gets to do it, but only twice. And it's, you know, I'm not going to tease too much about it, but it's a surprising conclusion to, you know, careful what you wish for type of thing.
We have interviewed 350 plus of the most impactful authors on this podcast. It's been a huge honor. Prior to today's interview, I mentioned to someone I was interviewing what I thought was the most consequential novelist of my lifetime. And they asked me who, and I said your name, and they all say, because I think your books are, I think your books are a gift. I think your books are inspiring, they're real. They penetrate our soul about what our purpose is, our legacy, our mission. Your most recent book, The Little Liar, invites people to take account of their life, of their lives, and how they are going to move forward with their character. I feel like the world's at a crossroads in terms of how we honor and treat liars versus those who tell the truth and pay the consequence and own up to it. I appreciate you coming on today. Mitch Albom, 8 number one New York Times bestsellers, 40 plus million books sold. You deserve your success. Starting with Tuesdays with Maury, now with The Little Liar. Honored you joined us, Mitch Albom. Thanks for coming on today.
Been a pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
And we'll see you back here next week for a new conversation on leadership.